podcast is about the Marx brothers, but maybe next time we could talk a little bit about the Marx sisters, hmm? I mean, they're every bit as funny as the brothers, and they did it all with less grease paint and more actual facial hair. Put that in your razor and shave it.
It's the Marx Brothers Council Podcast with our very special guest stars, Eric Jacobson and Craig Shemin.
Yeah!
Hello, friends. This is Noah Diamond, and I have been looking forward to this one. It's episode 67. It's called Of Muppets and Marxes, and it's about the nexus of two of my favorite things. But first, let's say hello to my favorite co-host, Matthew Conium. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
I would like to take a moment to thank our listeners for the interest you have shown in Marxfest, coming to New York City for two weekends in May of this year, 2024. At marxfest.org, you can now see the complete schedule of, I've got to say, really amazing Marx Brothers events, and tickets will be available the first week in April. I hope to see you here in New York City in May. And now I would like to briefly turn the microphone over to our producer and editor, Bob Gassell, with a word about our recent Brain Donors Blu-ray giveaway.
Thank you, Noah. The video company Kino Lorber has recently released the first ever Blu-ray of Brain Donors, the great 1992 Marx Brothers-inspired comedy done by the team that brought you Airplane and The Naked Gun. We're all big fans of the film here. In fact, we devoted an entire episode to it. Back in episode 31, we were joined by producer David Zucker and screenwriter Pat Proft. So if you haven't heard that one, go back and check it out. It's a great episode. Anyhow, this Blu-ray contains a brand new high-definition transfer of the film, the original theatrical trailer, and two brand new commentary tracks, one of them featuring the director Dennis Dugan, who coincidentally directed Problem Child for our friend Scott Alexander. And the other commentary track was done by film journalist Stacey Lane Wilson. This disc is Region 1 only and is only available in North America for now. The good people at Kino Lorber were kind enough to provide us with some copies to giveaway, and if you follow us on our council Facebook page or on Twitter or read our blog, you knew about the contest because it's over. Sorry, folks. I want to once again congratulate our winners. They are David Beach, Anthony Scabelli, Sean Delaney, Anna Gomez, Alexandra Biome, and Scott Saturnai. And for everybody else out there, please, please check this one out. It's a wonderful, fun film, and the closest you're ever going to get to a modern-day Marx Brothers film. So that's about it from me. Now back to our regular programming.
Thank you, Bob, and thanks to everyone for participating in that contest, and thanks to Kino Lorber. Now then, let's get on with this most sensational, inspirational, celebrational, Muppetational podcast episode and meet our special guests. He is a writer, producer, and Muppet historian who serves as president of the nonprofit organization, the Jim Henson Legacy, and as guest curator for the ongoing Henson film series at the Museum of the Moving Image. His books include The Muppet Character Encyclopedia and the recent and excellent Sam and Friends, the story of Jim Henson's first television show, published by our friends at Bear Manor Media. It really makes me happy to introduce to you Mr. Craig Shemin. Hi, Craig.
Hello. And I'm not at all disappointed to have not won the Brain Donors Blu-ray.
It is widely available, and something tells me one will find its way into your collection, Craig.
That will happen.
Craig, for our listeners, is a member of the Marx Brothers Council Facebook group, and we have been trying to make this happen for a long time, and very happy to be talking to you today. And he is an Emmy-nominated puppeteer who has worked on Sesame Street since 1994 and on Muppet Projects since 2001. For over 20 years, he has been the principal performer of such beloved characters as Bert, Grover, Oscar the Grouch, Sam the Eagle, Animal, Fozzie Bear, and Miss Piggy on film, television, and more, including a beautiful and universe-expanding performance as Animal in the recent Disney Plus series, The Muppets Mayhem. If there's anything better than getting to be a Marx brother, it is getting to be Mr. Eric Jacobson. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Noah. Hello, everybody. I am so thrilled to be here. I'm a little afraid to come on, knowing your disdain for the puppet show scene and Monkey Business, but I am here and I'm ready to defend it, whatever it means.
We are thrilled to have you here and always thrilled with a dissenting opinion, especially one in response to our own dissenting opinions. We'll have to get into that. And we are speaking, I think, as we record this, it's 2 days after World Puppetry Day. So, as usual, we have almost good timing on the Marx Brothers Council podcast.
Have you guys sobered up yet?
I'm still celebrating.
It takes a good 3 days. But I think, you know, it's interesting. I think World Puppetry Day falls on the same day as World Poetry Day. So we should really do this whole thing in verse.
We really should. There's got to be a way to make this more confusing.
It can go worse. Or vice.
Yes, from bad to verse. Well, as you may know, we usually begin episodes with new guests by asking them for their Marx Brothers origin stories, how you first encountered the work of the brothers, how they became important to you, and perhaps what role or influence they've had on your life and work. Let's start with you, Eric. How did you first encounter the Marx Brothers?
Well, I was probably about 10 years old, visiting my grandparents in Houston, Texas, when I saw my first Marx Brothers movie. It was on PBS. I know it was on PBS because that's the only station my grandparents ever had on. And also because every 10 minutes they would stop for about 15 minutes to try and sell me a tote bag. What I don't recall, though, is which movie it was. The only big takeaway I can tell you is that it was one of them where Chico was playing the piano. So that doesn't really narrow it down.
So not Room Service or Duck Soup.
Yeah, yeah. But it's funny because that is what I remember most vividly from my first encounter with them was Chico's piano playing. And I don't know, to a 10-year-old kid, seeing those fingers just dance across the keyboard in such a enchanting way was so memorable to me. I think it was also a surprise to me. That was not something I expected to see in a Marx Brothers movie. I had a sense of who the Marx Brothers were, of course, from cartoons and the parodies you saw in Warner Brothers cartoons, and even, dare I say it, the Vlasic Pickle Stork. That may be sacrilegious to bring up here.
No, not at all.
But but it's, funnily enough, I think it was things like that that were the result of these ripples across the decades through pop culture that kept the Marx Brothers' spirit alive and kept them relevant. I knew when I watched the movie who they were already from all these other pop culture references. So it made me a bit excited to see them and to recognize, oh yeah, this is the guy who doesn't say anything and he honks his horn and runs around chasing women, and this is the guy who, oh yeah, well, he's not holding a pickle. He's holding a cigar, but that's got to be Groucho. Mm-hmm. So I think it was something of a surprise to see Chico playing the piano because that wasn't something that I had seen in any of the other references. That was my first encounter with them. So as I got older, I watched more Marx Brothers movies. I'd go to the video store, I'd seek them out, and I became a really big fan, but probably more of a casual fan until lately, until I discovered your podcast And so I want to thank you. I want to take a moment to thank you for this podcast, for bringing Marx Brothers fans together and giving them a place to share their enthusiasm for this great comedy team. It's been such a wonderful journey listening to you all and rewatching many of the movies, watching some I had never seen before, and then hearing your deep dives on them. It's just been a terrific journey, so thank you.
Have we changed your views on any of them?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. No, I don't think so. I think my views line up pretty much with yours. I do find that the Paramounts are the best, and it kind of goes downhill after Night of the Opera. But I enjoy them all still, although I have to admit I haven't seen Love Happy yet. I don't know what it's going to take to get me to see that one. You know, if you think that's the wrong decision, let me know.
And then we can all chip in and buy Eric a PBS tote bag or something.
Yeah, I might give Love Happy a soft recommend, you know. I wouldn't urge you too urgently to watch it, but you know, it does consistently not rank at the very bottom of our list. We can certainly say
high
that.
Praise indeed. Yeah.
Well, it's overwhelming and flattering, Eric, to hear that our podcast has played some role in your expanding Marx Brothers consciousness in recent years. Thank you for that. And the same question to you, Craig. How old were you, and what were the circumstances of the first time the Marx Brothers entered your world?
I would imagine I was under 10 years old, I think. And I grew up in the New York metropolitan area. So we had Channel 9 and Channel 5 and Channel 11 mostly showing older movies. And I think the first one I came upon was The Coconuts, because I remember Wyatt Duck. I remember that sequence, and I think I didn't really understand what it was all meaning, but it just seemed like it was being done in a funny way, so it was funny to me. And that was sort of like that kind of was the whole idea behind the early days of Sesame Street, is that kids might not understand the specifics of why things are funny, but it's done in a funny way that's still entertaining to them, and the parents get it. But so when I was exposed to Wyatt Duck and the Coconuts, I wanted to see more, but this was a pre-VCR world. I think the next thing that I was drawn to was the books, the Oboli books, the Wyatt Duck book. And then when I found out about it, I got Hooray for Captain Spaulding, because it came out later because of the whole rights issue. And shortly after that, the world of VCRs came, and my brother got one of the first VCRs. It was a big, clunky RCA VHS model. And I was able to watch more Marx Brothers because my brother got this amazing gadget. And I say amazing in quotes. It was called The Killer. And it was something that could be plugged into a VCR and would automatically pause the VCR when it got to commercials. But the only thing that didn't make it truly amazing was that it would only work for black and white movies, because it was triggered by the switch where they switched from black and white to color at master control. So you could record any black and white movie and have the commercials taken out. So my brother was so into this. So he was recording every black and white movie. So we had these 6-hour speed tapes of Marx Brothers and Abbott and Costello. We weren't really into Bowery Boys, but if it aired on Channel 11, you know, or Channel 9 or Channel 5, we would get it. So that's when I was able to see Monkey Business and Duck Soup and the rest of the things. And then around the same time, I had that 4-record set.
In the orange box.
Yes. And that had so many cool things, and that's how I got exposed to the radio.
The bane of John Tefteller's existence.
And I was starting to identify at that point the people, you know, what Groucho, what his mind thought like, how his mind worked. Because before then, it was just these characters. And then I remember there was one moment in the big show with Tallulah Bankhead where he says a joke and it didn't get a great response. He's waiting. And then the next thing is, okay, I waited, goody.
I'll tell you what, let's make up a sponsor, the Plebo Company.
The Plebo Company, how do you spell it?
C-O-M-P-A-N-Y. I waited, Goody. Let's get this program to the class.
You know, and then I'm like going like, what does that mean? And then I was like, oh, you know, figured out later, Goodman Ace wrote the script and must have told him this is funny, but you got to wait for the laugh. And I'm starting to think this is the way that the man's mind works, and he'll just put it in the show. And they'll talk about what page they're on and things like that. And that really took it in a different direction, because then I'm starting to think, well, somebody's involved in putting this together. And that, I think that may have been, you know, some of my earliest interest in wanting to pursue this as a field.
What a great thing for to put together, especially in a child's mind, that he was talking to the writer, Goodman Ace, apprising him on the progress of the material as the show was happening.
Yeah, and I think the big show was live, so you know, it was, you know, he just didn't care. He just... I think that evolved. And then my parents owned a video store when I was in high school, so I was able to have access to material. My parents were classic film fans. My mom had worked at the National Screen Company that made all the trailers and posters and stuff. So she was interested in, and a lot of the other video stores wouldn't stock the classic movies when they came out, but my parents did. And they were always left on the shelf at the end of the day so I could take them home and watch them. So that's a long, exhausting story about how I first came into the Marx world.
I am still wide awake. And
we'll see what we can do about that.
We'll see what we can do about that. when you talk about the Marx Brothers a lot, one question that constantly comes up is, you know, some variation on who else is like the Marx Brothers, or where do you see their influence, or where would you go to get a little bit more of what you get from the Marx Brothers? And it's a very understandable, natural question, but it's also kind of a frustrating one, partly because, you know, the whole point here is that really nobody is like the Marx Brothers. Their uniqueness is why we're here talking about them. But, you know, the problems with the question are sort of italicized by the inadequacy of the answers, which tend to be lists of irreverent comedians. People mention Wheeler and Woolsey sometimes, or the Ritz Brothers, Olson and Johnson, or later teams like Monty Python and Fire Sign Theater. Those are all great comic entities, and we can certainly trace some of what they do back to the Marx Brothers. Mel Brooks and Woody Allen come up a lot too. Irreverent farceurs. But not to take anything away from any of those artists, it always seems to me that they're not really doing the same thing the Marx Brothers did. They obviously learned from them, but they're unsatisfying answers. And to me, the most satisfying answer to the question has always been the Muppets. And one of the reasons the Muppets are my favorite answer to the who else is like the Marx Brothers question is because it is both a good substantive answer and an unexpected one. People aren't thinking about the Muppets because they're a different kind of entity, you know, in many obvious reasons. Because they're not, strictly speaking, a comedy team or conventional comedians. And it sort of reinforces the uniqueness of the Marx Brothers to say that to get anywhere near the feeling I get from them, you need this massive, innovative, artistic project spanning decades wrought by geniuses reinventing their medium. You know, that's what it takes to get anywhere near them. And I think when I first encountered the Marx Brothers as a little kid, one of the reasons I took to them so quickly is because I already had the Muppets in my head, and the Marx Brothers reminded me of the Muppets. And so I wonder if for either of you if that was a connection that jumped out in the early days. And I'm presuming that you both were familiar with the Muppets before the Marx Brothers. I guess that may not be true.
No, I think it is, at least for me. Certainly Sesame Street I knew before the Muppets. And I think the Muppet Show probably a little after my first introduction to the Marxes. Oh, how about you, Eric?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely was exposed to the Muppets on Sesame Street first, before anything else, really. That was my first TV show, for sure, that I watched. And perhaps the first place where I saw a reference to the Marx Brothers, too, because they did do that from time to time. They would make references to Chaplin and other silent comedians as well. You know, they would, because the people who worked on that show were so inspired by the classic comedians. But yeah, once you get, though, to the Muppet Show, I think it becomes really evident how their DNA is shared with classic comedians and the Marx Brothers in particular.
Yeah, especially the vaudeville environment. And,
yeah,
you know, you look at some of the acts that were on the Muppet Show that were not regulars and some that were, they could conceivably fit on a bill along with Swain's Rats and Cats and real things. You know, you had Lou Zealand and his boomerang fish and Angus McGonagall, the gargling gargoyle. And these were things that, you know, I had once put together a Muppet trivia event, and I had a list of real human beings and Muppet characters, because the people of that era had very Muppety names if you were in vaudeville. I think that whole environment and the fact that they were bringing this level of anarchy and bedlam to what would normally be a relatively staid environment, that's more so in the movies. You know, you get more of that clear, we're going to put silly characters into a completely normal situation. In the Muppet Show, the whole place is really a silly environment.
Yeah, yeah. And you can go down the list. I came up with a list of similarities or shared DNA that the Muppet Show and the Marx Brothers have. And you have absurdist comedy, you know, whether in the Muppets it's talking food or with the Marx Brothers, a tattoo coming to life. You have slapstick and visual gags. You mentioned it already, a sense of anarchy. And almost every single sketch or music number with the Muppets would just end in complete chaos. And we actually have a name for it. You know, okay, we're going to do a rave off at the end of this bit. Everybody rave off, which means basically go crazy. And yeah, I mean, there's all the puns. And
there was even some dialect humor, you know.
Yeah.
Good grief, the comedian's a bear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, he's a nut. He's a wearing a necktie.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
You have to pay Eric more that he's done that, you know.
Gladly. There's something about the use of puns and wordplay. It's not just that it's wordplay for its own sake, but it's a sort of brazen use of the kind of wordplay that normally would be received very badly, that would make people groan and get upset. But the joke is more than just the text of the joke. It's also just having the brazenness to deliver that joke, you know, enthusiastically. The Muppets and the Marx Brothers both change the standards around for what is an acceptable piece of verbal humor.
I agree. I think one of the things that about I'm glad you said that it's not just about being a pun, because I get annoyed when you're a Muppet writer and say, oh, I love the puns. And I'm like, that's not really the point. You know, it's about servicing the overall humor of the piece. And, you know, the material, you know, it worked so well in the Muppet Show because you're in this sort of vaudeville music hall environment. And Jerry Jewell once told me a story that he saw that Jim was looking at the script and was not very happy. And Jerry thought it was just this really bad joke. And he said, oh, you know, if it's that joke, we can get a better one. And Jim said something like, oh, no, it's not that joke. That joke is really awful, but it's worthy of us.
Beautiful. Jerry Jewell, for any of our listeners who may not know, was the head writer of The Muppet Show and arguably the most important writer, would you say, in the Muppets saga? And a truly great comedy writer who could have written for the Marx Brothers.
I would say that, yeah.
Matthew, it occurs to me that in all the years you and I have spent talking about the Marx Brothers and related subjects, I don't think we've ever really talked about the Muppets, despite the Muppets coming up on this podcast a few times as a result of my enthusiasm. How do you feel about the Muppets, Matthew? Did they play a role in your childhood? When did you discover them? And what do you think of them?
They certainly did play a role in my childhood. I was born in 1973, so I was exactly the right age for the Muppet Show when it hit. It was a massive hit over here. It was one of those things that, you know, the whole country was talking about.
And it was produced in England, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, and we had, I believe we had, because of our the nature of our TV slots, our half hours only had one advert break and went a lot further than yours, so I believe we actually had extra material in our versions. So yeah, it was a massive hit. I loved it, as did everybody else. Had all the toys, bought the LPs and so on. Also, I remember a lovely occasion when lots of the characters appeared as guests. Often, you know, people in costumes would show up at events, things, you know, the Muppets are appearing. I remember our school had the Muppets visiting, and I remember a neighbor, it's like a family joke, one of the great family Conium family jokes, is a neighbor shouting at the top of her voice across the schoolroom to her son, come and have your photo taken with Hermit the Crab. So it was a very big thing.
It's one of those off-brand Muppets.
Yes. more pointedly, though, in the last 10 years, I've got to watch them all again, because my son Edward is a huge fan as well, and we've been watched the DVDs together. So I've been able to not only kind of reconnect with the enjoyment of them, but also to enjoy a lot of things that I didn't get first time round, notably, you know, the vaudeville nature of it, the vintage nature of the songs, and several of the jokes, it must be said also. But also just how innovative it was, how it didn't look like anything similar had previously looked. Just very simple but very, very interesting ideas, like having the characters such different sizes, some of them puppets, some of them men in suits, things like that. The brilliance of the character design in many cases. The example I always give being Dr. Honeydew having glasses but no eyes, which sounds like it wouldn't work, but you see him and it's absolutely perfect. He's a scientist because he's got glasses and no eyes. Wonderful details like that. So yeah, I mean, it is something that I would say is among the kind of half dozen, you know, greatest things of its type. I guess I would say the only thing that disappointed me slightly watching them again is that, bearing in mind that it is or appears to be basically the work of hippies and although it's never, ever hectoring, you know, its underlying attitudes are clearly progressive and pointing the right way. It's just a little bit disappointing to me how much of the humour revolves around cruelty to animals and meat eating and, you know, making jokes about pork in front of pig characters and that kind of stuff. So that strikes me as slightly a missed opportunity, but that's all, really. What I can't really remember is when it struck me how much of a Marx Brothers tie-up there is there. Obviously, I had the LP when it came out, which had Lydia on it. I had that before I'd heard of the Marx Brothers. It was a long time after I got into the Marx Brothers that I saw at the circus, but I'd certainly knew by then that Lydia was a Groucho song. I can't remember when I found that out, but there was no kind of surprise associated with it. So my awareness of that connection is somehow kind of lost in a blurred bit of time in between the two. I remember, for instance, watching Sesame Street when I was a teenager and noting that one of the Muppet News flashes was from Horse Feathers County. So I was absolutely on top of it. But unfortunately, I can't quite remember when it struck me. But now, of course, obviously, you look at it and it's obvious and it's wonderful.
I will say that whenever somebody made a pig joke in front of Miss Piggy, they got their just desserts.
That's true. That's very true.
As well as an appetizer and an entree.
Yeah. Miss Piggy could always handle herself. I do remember sometimes feeling bad for some of the live animals who crossed the Swedish chef's counter.
Yes.
Well, I think the other thing to remember about the animal so-called cruelty is that Jim Henson started doing these shows very early. There's someone wrote a book about the whole early days of the Muppets. But it goes back to an era of puppetry and hundreds of years back to an era of puppetry where it was just all about this slapstick behavior. It wasn't really regarded that the puppets were that realistic. So you had Punch and Judy beating the hell out of each other and things like that. So I think that sort of was the mindset for Jim. And, you know, in the 1960s, when he was doing variety shows, most of the sketches ended with one character eating the other or one of the characters blowing up. So I think that, when that sort of pervaded in the Muppet Show at a time while the characters were becoming more and more realistic in people's eyes. So I think there may have become a time where they sort of, you know, got to a point where they were doing things that could be seen by an audience as being overly violent because Jim had done such a great job in making the characters look real.
Yes, and I should stress that I certainly didn't have any problem with violence per se. I love that. I don't know his name, or if he's got a name, but that mad character that comes on every so often and blows things up.
Crazy Harry.
Crazy
Harry.
Yeah. He's wonderful, obviously, and that's a great element of the show.
It is true when you see the Muppet Show now, and many of us have had a chance to revisit it in great detail because it's available on Disney Plus now. With the extra UK segments, Matthew, many of us in the States are seeing for the first time on Disney Plus. It is true that it is a product of an earlier time. And when you consider how, you know, Jim Henson and his collaborators seem to be beyond reproach as far as their hearts being in the right place all the time. I mean,
yes,
there's never any malicious intention behind anything they do. And yet, as a product of the 1970s, for the most part, you know, you do run into racial depictions on The Muppet Show that they would never have done now and things like that. It is one more yardstick for how times have changed.
And there are disclaimers on the Disney broadcasts of The Muppet Show, Disney Plus streams.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that I think it holds up is that the whole look and the music choice and everything was already kind of old looking when it went on the air.
Yeah.
You know, they were doing in 1976, they were doing a show that, you know, was almost like Texaco Star Theater. You know, they were doing a show and a good deal of the music were, you know, Tin Pan Alley songs, from the 20s, 30s, 40s.
The best way to make something timeless is to set it in an earlier time, I find. You know, if it's a movie from the 70s about the 40s or something, you know, it carries over the decades much better, because you're not seeing everybody wearing those extremely garish, you know, wide ties and lapels.
And that's also why I love it when the guest star is somebody like Bob Hope or George Burns or Milton Berle, because there you can see, you know, I obviously at the time I didn't know who they were, but I watched them now on there and you can see that they get it. They absolutely get it. With the other guest stars, there was actually a running joke in Britain that we never knew who they were. It's very hard to believe, but actually in the 70s, there really wasn't a lot of bleed over between British and American television. It was very, very rare that we would give a primetime slot to an American program. And it was usually a drama, a cop series or you know, something like the A-Team or the Incredible Hulk or something like that. Comedy much less so, and variety I think virtually never. So there was actually a sketch, quite a famous sketch in our program called Not the 9 o'clock News, comedy program with Rowan Atkinson and Mel Smith from Brain Donors, where the four stars were sat in armchairs reading the Sunday newspapers, and they would read out something shocking like, "Oh my God, look at this! There's been a nuclear disaster somewhere or other," and then somebody else would say, "Oh no, unemployment is set to reach 3 million," and then the last one was Griffiths Jones, who said, "My God, there's somebody I've heard of as a guest on the Muppet Show this week," and they all throw their newspapers down and rush over to where he is to see who this guest is. But it is the case, you know, that we very rarely knew who they were, and I have to say, in many cases, I still don't. But yeah, when it is an old vaudevillian, it obviously that adds a wonderful dimension to it.
Are you saying you're not a big Lola Falana fan, Matthew?
I'm the world's biggest Lola Falana fan.
And, you know, in some of the earlier episodes, there were, you know, it was a hard sell to get a guest star to go to England, because this was a show that had not been on the air yet. So they relied on calling in favors of other people that they had worked with on American television before. So there were a lot of people who didn't know who some of those guest stars were. It wasn't just the English.
Even today, a lot of them are sort of buried in time. I mean, there are obviously Muppet Show guest stars who are still, you know, very famous names, but a lot who were hot at the time, I assume, and no longer are. I started to make a list of specifically comedy legends who I encountered for the first time as guest stars on The Muppet Show. It's an incomplete list, but in addition to George Burns and Bob Hope, who Matthew has just mentioned, Danny Kaye, Edgar Bergen, Milton Berle, Carol Burnett, Steve Martin, Spike Milligan, John Cleese, and in the Muppet movie, Mel Brooks, who his appearance in that film just turned my whole world around, you know, and I thought, oh, I want to talk like that. I want to talk like that guy. But then in addition to introducing us to all these comedians, The Muppet Show also introduced us to, you know, red curtains and early 20th century typefaces and the idea that the most fun you could possibly have is to put on a show with your friends.
Yeah, I think that that is sort of the key of it, that you know, they're putting on a show and the whole running thing is that they never have a budget. They never have any money. And the irony is that it was one of the most expensive shows in syndication at the time. But it just, it's so great that, you know, backstage, they never have any money. But on stage, it always looks great.
Yeah. It occurs to me, too, that if things had just been a little different with the timing, if The Muppet Show had started a little earlier or if Groucho had lived a little longer, he might have been a guest star. He even spent time in England, you know, late in his career. Could you imagine Scooter knocking on the door and saying, you know, "Mr. Marks, 15 seconds to curtain, Mr. Marks." My goodness, that's high on my list of might have beens.
It's very easy to imagine. I can completely see that show. It's, and Wow. That would have been amazing.
Do we know if he ever saw it? I mean, I know we're talking about the very, very last days of Groucho here and probably not too aware of anything, but I'm sure he would have loved it, wouldn't he? There's no question he would have loved it.
Yeah, I feel that strongly, but I don't have any evidence of him ever mentioning it.
Mm.
I mean, The Muppet Show started in 76, right? So it really is toward the very end.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, what we can sort of see elements of what might have been through the other, his other peers who did make it, and you know, with varying levels of success. I think that, you know, some of them were great, and, you know, I think all of them were great, but some were more willing to submit themselves to the Muppet world, and I think some, Milton Berle comes to mind, it's sort of, he came, you know, with a list of jokes that he basically dictated to the Muppet Show writers. He didn't want to try anything that hadn't been used over and over again. And everyone else was sort of like, you know, put me in your hands and you know, I trust you guys.
Yeah.
I have to say that scene, though, between Milton Berle and Fozzie.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful.
On stage is one of my all-time favorites.
If you want to be the top banana, you gotta start from the bottom of the bun.
You gotta know the joke about the farmer's daughter.
Then take it in the kisser with the soda water.
Yeah, I'm sure Berle dictated every word in that sketch, but it delivers.
Oh, he knew what he, you know, he knew what worked for him.
Yeah.
Hey, I recall reading that Berle tried something similar when he hosted Saturday Night Live, and it didn't go so well.
Yes, I dare say that Berle's Muppet Show appearance went very much better than his Saturday Night Live appearance.
The website Muppet Wiki has a very exhaustive list of Marx Brothers, specific Marx Brothers references in the works of the Muppets, and there really are a lot of them. Some of the most oft-discussed examples are cases where Marx Brothers material is appropriated by the Muppets, like Kermit doing Lydia. Also, Rolf the Dog's Show Me a Rose is just beautiful.
One night in Bixby, Mississippi, we watched the clouds roll by. I said, my dear, how are you? And she whispered, so am I.
Well, and Rolf also did Lydia on his album.
Oh.
During the run of The Muppet Show, or shortly after, Jim recorded a Rolf album that just sort of sat in the vault for years and years. And when I was at Henson, a man named Robert Kraft was running our music department, and he went through everything in storage and found this album. And he brought in musicians, put together an orchestral backing, because, you know, Jim had just recorded the basic, you know, vocal and piano track. And they turned it into a beautiful album, which I will say I came up with the title for, Old Brown Ears Is Back.
Which is a fabulous title.
Oh, my goodness. I've never heard that, but I will hear it later today, I guarantee you.
And Rolf and Sam, of course, also do Tick Willow, don't they? And make a point of mentioning the word obdurate, which has to be a reference.
Absolutely.
100%.
I think it's safe to assume that Jerry Jewell was a big Marx Brothers fan, because years later, when they did the Muppets Celebrate Jim Henson, they and Jerry was one of the writers on this, and so was Bill Prady, but they introduced the Merrill Lunch, Hunger Dunger, and McCormick Marching Society of Accountants that come through. And I think that you don't pull that out of thin air.
Absolutely. Yeah, that special, that was the first new Muppet product after Jim Henson's death. And it was a really big deal. I think I was maybe 12 years old. And I remember recording it from television and watching it over and over again.
I was playing Waldorf in the back row.
Is that so?
You were.
My first and only big Muppet appearance.
No kidding.
Wow.
Another similarity between the Marx Brothers and the Muppets, or a connection between them that stands out to me, is the idea of that joy is the main thing being communicated. It's not often said about the Marx Brothers. I think because we're often in a rush to identify the Marx Brothers as rebellious and revolutionary. They're anarchists. They're anti-establishment. Things are all true about them. But it seems to me that they're not angry. The Marx Brothers aren't destructive out of anger. They're destructive out of joy. You know, it's the sheer pleasure of destroying a room or a situation. And the Muppets are like that, I think, too. The main thing that comes across is joy, the sheer joy of humor and entertainment, song and dance. That's another angle that the Marx Brothers, like the Muppets, they simultaneously seem to be playing characters, but they are also professional entertainers, you know, and they have like their bag of vaudevillian tricks. If Groucho's a doctor, he's a doctor who sings and dances, you know. And the same is true about the Muppets.
Say what you will about the anarchy of and the wildness of the Marx Brothers, they always want the good guys to win. Always sort of end up, you know, on the side of the young lovers that we really don't care too much about. But they want them to, you know, they want them to have their chance to sing opera on the stage, and they want them to save the institution.
And, you know, they're brothers, so it makes sense for them to have a brotherhood. But there is this love that you see among them. There's not all this conflict that you see with many other teams, where, you know, they're slapping each other or poking each other in the eyes, a la the Three Stooges, or where they're just butting heads constantly. If there's any kind of conflict, say, in a scene between Chico and Groucho always seems to be very, he's more curious to see where this is going to go. You know, he's not agreeing with Chico, maybe one bit, but he's just seems more curious than upset or angry with Chico. And, you know, when they come in, you know, at the beginning of a film and they're doing their handshake, it's just this joyous revelry. And likewise with the Muppets, there's never any mean-spiritedness between them. Yeah, not so much, right? There's always a sense that they love each other, and all the antics are just silliness that they grin and bear through.
Yeah, pun intended.
Ah.
Yes. Yes, the camaraderie is notable. I mean, I was a very sort of quite a morbidly sensitive boy, and there was one episode which I'm not sure whereabouts it comes, because I haven't. It's not one that I've seen again with Edward. I'd love to see it again. Where I may even be misremembering it. This could be a cigar line situation. But my memory is that Fozzie gets replaced by another comedian. He gets kicked off the bill, and they get another comedian on. So there's lots of sympathy for Fozzie, which I was completely on board with. But then at the end, when Fozzie comes back, I was really worrying about this other comedian, about what was going to happen to him. So I hope that's a true memory. But even if it isn't, it illustrates my point, which is that worries like that, which I used to get all the time from TV programs, were incredibly rare on the Muppets. That's the only example I can think of, because of this sense of camaraderie, this sense of theatre, you know, of the all these guys getting together to put on a show. And even the mean-spiritedness of Statler and Waldorf obviously doesn't dent it, because they're sort of part of the act too.
Yes, and seen almost outside of the ensemble of Muppets. They're, of course, a part of the ensemble by the mere fact that they're puppets too, but they're sitting in the audience.
Even when you see them in the movies, they're always sort of distanced from the action. You know, in Great Muppet Caper, they're sitting on a park bench watching the other characters ride bicycles.
They're my son's favorite. Rolf and Statler and Waldorf are my son's favorite Muppet characters.
One interesting difference maybe between the Marx Brothers and the Muppets is that the Muppets do frequently make specific appeals to our sympathies. You know, I mean, the Muppets are sentimental, and they do deliberately push emotional buttons very effectively. The Marx Brothers tend not to. Maybe Harpo's solos are the one place in the Marx Brothers' best work where you can identify a kind of deliberate, ingratiating approach to the audience. And I suppose part of this is because the Muppets have one foot in children's entertainment, family entertainment. They also have, like, the Muppet Show has this convention of the show within the show and the backstage story happening at the same time, where emotions come into play more and situation comedy more than in the Marx Brothers.
Not a lot of people know this, though, Noah, that Irving Thalberg was instrumental in the Muppet Show evolution to bring in those moments of pathos and emotion. Of course, he had been dead decades, but that didn't stop him.
This is something I wanted to ask you, Craig. There's never going to be a perfect analogy here, but I wonder, reading your book, you know, is there something to be said about Sam and Friends as the Paramount period and then the Muppets as the MGM period in the Henson world?
I think there is something to that, because they really weren't concerned with the emotional arc, you know, for the most part, because they only had, you know, 3.5-4 minutes to do a bit. But what's kind of interesting about the Sam and Friends era is whether Jim was planning to or not, you know, these were very sort of prototypical, you know, early Muppet characters. But you had Sam, who was silent, and you had, you know, very energetic, fast-talking character, Professor Madcliffe. You had, you know, a country dialect of Moldy Hay. So you had sort of things that were, you know, and Harry played the piano. But he was more than that. He was also the hipster. But, you know, whether Jim was consciously trying this or doing this on purpose, you had characters that were sort of playing similar roles that the Marxes had. And I think that, you know, though Sam and Friends era was purely about the joke, there was music, they would lip sync to recordings, but it was purely about comedy, really not about anything emotional. So I think that there is something to compare the Sam and Friends era to the Paramounts.
And we always say when we're doing Muppet projects that, you know, the plot really is not that important. You know, it's just, you just need something to hang all the jokes on. And I think you see that in the movies themselves. The plots are pretty bare, and it's very interesting to see, to compare the actual movies that the Muppets have done as well with the Marx Brothers. I always go back to the Great Muppet Caper, and I see so much there that feels like a Thalberg,
yeah,
Marx,
yeah,
Brothers movie.
It's definitely an MGM Marx movie. And I think that that's one of the, you know, I think the Muppets in the movies are best when they are doing that, when they're sort of taking this broad movie genre and just plopping the Muppets in the middle of it and bringing their brand of humor and madness to, you know.
It's another similarity how they're cast too, isn't it? Where the Marx Brothers are always playing basically just another version of the characters we saw them on their last outing, and you know, with different names, mm-hmm, and different occupations.
Yeah, and sometimes they have relationships, like in Great Muppet Caper, Kermit and Fozzie are brothers.
Yeah,
identical twin brothers.
No less.
And you know, you also have Muppets Take Manhattan, where you have that you know, that the young female ingenue human who would be the young female ingenue human in the Marx Brothers, who ends up being in Brain Donors.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
See, there are lots of connections, mm-hmm, many levels.
Mm-hmm. No doubt about it. I would like to talk about performance a little bit. I mean, obviously, with both the Marx Brothers and the Muppets, the humans behind the characters are so important. In a way, it feels like the Marx Brothers you can think of their characters as puppets that are being operated by Julius and Arthur and Leonard, you know. They even sort of look like Muppets or puppets. Their makeup and costumes are so fanciful. And you're aware, especially if you're the kind of fan who likes to know everything about them and read the books and all that, you kind of feel like you know the guys inside those characters too, and you can sense them at the controls operating them. Eric, I wouldn't presume to compare myself to you, but in my experiences playing Groucho Marx, I've thought of you as just a model of how to honorably inhabit characters people love that were created by other people, by their original creators, in a way that's unmistakable and recognizable and confirms what people want from these characters. But at the same time, you're endlessly inventive and creative. The idea that anything could happen, which is the feeling we got from those characters when we first encountered them, is still very much there. It's like the combination of having so much respect and reverence for the originals, but at the same time, irreverence is sort of the coin of the realm, right? And you don't want to put velvet ropes up around Fozzie Bear or Groucho Marx and be too respectful. I wonder if I'd like to stop babbling about this and let you babble about it, but maybe if you would just respond to some of these ideas. What is that like, honoring these characters?
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliments. Recreating somebody else's character is pretty daunting, am I right? I actually just saw Frank Ferrante do his one-man show about a week ago, and he is masterful at it, I have to say. I was just grinning from ear to ear the entire time. He was just simply mesmerizing. And after the show, I got a chance to speak with him ever so briefly, and for some reason, I used the word reanimation to describe what both he and I do, and perhaps it was uncouth of me, but I do think there is something to the word. As a puppeteer, I am tasked with bringing inanimate objects to life. In the specific case, though, of portraying a character like Miss Piggy, or with you and Frank bringing to life Groucho, it goes way beyond that. It's a matter of bringing to life a character that has lived before. And that is supremely challenging because everybody already knows what Fozzie Bear is supposed to sound like, or what Groucho is supposed to sound like, or how either one of those two is supposed to behave and act and move. So you're inevitably going to be compared to all of the media that pre-exists your portrayal of this character. But beyond that, you're also competing against people's memories of these characters, which don't always line up with reality. Hypothetically, you could give a pitch-perfect performance and still fall short of people's expectations because they remember the character differently. This is something I actually consider when I first inherit a character. I sit down and I say to myself, what comes to people's minds when they think of this character? Miss Piggy had been around for a long time before I came around, and even on the hand of a singular man, she changed and evolved over the years. So I had to decide which version of this character am I going to try to emulate. And ultimately, I decided most people formed their memories of Miss Piggy from when she was on The Muppet Show. So that's what I have tried to do. For Oscar the Grouch, it was a little bit different. I picked things up a little bit closer to where Carol Spinney left off. But I'm sure you, Noah, and other Marx Brothers revivalists have gone through a similar process when it comes to recreating the roles of Groucho and his brothers. Groucho was Groucho for a very long time, and Coconut's Groucho is very different from the Groucho who appeared on Dick Cavett. So you have to decide which version are you going to do. And maybe it's a little bit from column A and a little bit from column B, because Groucho remained iconic throughout all the different phases of his career. Anyways, yeah. It's hard what we do. It helps to be a mimic, but you have to do your homework, no matter how good a mimic you are and no matter how long you've been a fan. You can't just try and do what you've seen before. Yeah, especially with the Muppets, because they continue to star in new productions and say things that they never said before.
I want to piggyback on that for a second.
Yeah.
Have you ever come across a situation where you're dealing with a screenwriter or a TV special writer who may not know the characters as well as you, and they're writing stuff that you don't think fits, you know, what the character should be doing? Is that ever an issue?
Sure. Well, yeah, absolutely. And it can be very tricky sometimes. And, you know, you try and nudge things this way or the other. You want to be respectful to the writers and all the other people who are involved. And, you know, sometimes you're able to make it your own, and other times you have to kind of say, okay, well, we'll just barrel through and get to the part that makes more sense to me. But you try to have discussions with the writers and the production team, and usually you can work it out. Usually, you know, everybody's there at the end of the day to achieve the same thing.
I know when I'm in a situation like that as a writer, I always keep in mind that, you know, while writers assigned to do all of these things are thinking about the whole big picture, each of these performers are really the guardians of their characters. And they are thinking about it in ways that a writer may not be thinking about. And they will know exactly the other things that the character has dealt with recently and try to sort of reconcile all of that with the script. And I know, just like a couple of years ago, I worked on something with Eric, and I just wrote a Miss Piggy joke. Jim Lewis and I wrote a Miss Piggy joke, and there was nothing wrong with it. But Eric reached out and said, you know, Piggy's not at that place with Kermit right now, and I don't think she would want to have that be the joke. And, you know, and Eric was totally right. We just were thinking about Miss Piggy at a different time and place, and Eric is dealing with what's happening now with Piggy. So we're like, oh, yeah, we'll just change it around. It's no big deal. And I think that, you know, at least in my case as a writer, I'm thankful that someone is sort of looking after that. Is, you know, when I started out at Henson, when I was first a writer, I did all of these sort of in-between show things. I did a lot of the talk show appearances. And Frank Oz was always a part of that. And Eric became a part of that, you know, trying to figure out what Piggy's mindset or what Fozzie's mindset is for a particular thing. So I think it's a great value to have the character, to have the puppeteers, the performers involved in that process.
It's the most fun part of it, really, is okay, you get a script and then you go to the floor on Sesame Street and we try and plus it. You know, we play, we try to play, and in the play, you know, in the rehearsals, we will just blurt out something and it makes somebody laugh. And so we say, should we keep that in? Yes, absolutely. Keep that in. And then, you know, you say, okay, well, what if I do this? And, you know, what if you take this, the first half of this line, and I'll take the second half? You know, we adore each other on set, all the performers, and, you know, the writers are usually there to help out and, you know, just, you know, make sure that we're not going completely off the rails and because it can turn into a house of cards very quickly.
Well, I'll tell you, so I wish the Marx Brothers were as protective of their characters as in the later years as you are.
And if only they had writers that cared that much, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's the funny thing. I wanted to ask you all, you know, I always heard that Groucho really saw himself or wanted to be seen first and foremost as a writer. And I'm just wondering, like, well, was it just the weight of the studio system and just how things worked that he didn't actually write any of the later scripts, or, you know, try to like get in there and help make those scripts better?
It's one of those questions. I mean, my best guess is that it's not, there isn't one answer to that. That it was just a combination of factors. It's very unfortunate. But I think just by that time, he had ceased to care. He just literally just didn't care. And if he had still cared, you would think that he would, because there's lots of stories, ironically, about him being very, very rude to the writers in the Paramount days, back when the scripts were great, you know, saying, you know, what is this rubbish, you know, and sitting in on the a lot of the scripting sessions, or making changes during the read-throughs and stuff like that, and really, you know, genuinely being involved. I think by the end, it was partly because he really didn't want to be there anymore, and he was older and he was tired and he wanted to do other things. And then the other factor is, as you say, the great weight of this kind of studio, you know, the sheer mechanics of how it worked, and unfortunately how that side of things was stocked by people who didn't know much about them and didn't care.
That one interesting connection is that Groucho Marx in the 20s and 30s didn't look like his character off stage until he grew a mustache in the quiz show era. Harpo and Chico didn't really look like their characters either. And so they had this strange combination of public anonymity along with, you know, super stardom. Eric, you play some of the most famous, recognizable, to use the most overused word of the age, iconic characters in the world. But if you're eating in a restaurant, people don't know that necessarily. What is that like, the distance between who you physically are in the world and the characters you play? Is that a lucky break?
Oh, yeah. I'm very grateful for it. It's like being a superhero, right? And, you know, Clark Kent, nobody pays any attention to. And that is the way I like it. but it's, you know, it's great to be, to have this, this comic book life as well. I always wanted, when I was a kid, I always wanted to grow up to be a superhero. I actually really wanted to do that.
And when Eric takes off his glasses, people are like, hey, there's the guy who does Fozzie Bear.
And this is about the closest thing possible to growing up to being a superhero. It's just, you know, to, because you know, the Muppets were heroes to me.
I want to brag on Eric just a little bit, because, you know,
you want me to leave, Craig? Should I leave?
No. One of the things that he does so well is not say things. He has an incredible way of timing and knowing when not to have to say any dialogue. And we did a thing a few years ago in New Zealand where we were doing this concert with the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra, and Sam Eagle comes out to sort of say how awful it is that we brought this mess of a show to out of America and into New Zealand. And he comes out, and just before saying anything, he has this great stare to looking at the conductor, and you know, there maybe it was a half a page of dialogue, but Eric was able to do it in a way and milk every laugh. So it took like 3 minutes to get through this bit, but just, you know, just the looks, just, and this is, you know, this is not easy, because it's a character, it's a puppet, you know, Sam has some expression in his eyes, but you know, it's such an amazing thing in comedy to begin with. You know, it's something to appreciate when comedians and characters know when to leave a little air in the thing, and the laughs come. And I think that it was just so fun to watch. and someone who wrote that bit to know that there were laughs coming when nothing was being said. It was just a wonderful thing. So, Eric, you're wonderful.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you. I can leave now so you can tell them what you really think. But, no, I appreciate it. It's, you know, it just reminds me, though, too, just how jealous I am of comedians like the Marx Brothers, who do have the full faculty of their facial expressions to deliver those beautiful silent moments with a waggle of their eyebrows or the wink of an eye or just a little smirk or an eye roll. And those, none of those things are things that we can do as puppeteers.
But a good puppeteer can take that in such a way. You know, I still get people telling me, oh, you know, I love when Miss Piggy bats her eyelashes.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that is the remarkable thing when you watch them is just how much character does come across through what are essentially immobile features. I mean, Kermit in particular does a little sort of, it looks to camera, to which convey frustration somehow. Although, you know, obviously that face doesn't change, but somehow it does. It does come across. It is remarkably clever and interesting.
Yeah, you know, a couple of years ago, I rewatched The Muppets Take Manhattan because I was invited to discuss it on the Moving Right Along podcast hosted by our friends Anthony Strand and Ryan Rowe. And watching that Empire State Building scene with Kermit, you know, the frog is staying, which is maybe the key scene of my life. you're looking at Kermit. It's a view of Kermit. It's the back of his head, you know. It's just a green shape with two white shapes on top. It really, we're just looking at abstract shapes at that point, looking out over the Manhattan skyline. But because, I suppose, of the brilliance of the character design, and because Jim Henson is such a brilliant actor, you know, there's not a flesh and blood actor in the world who could convey that level of emotion and go right to your heart the way that little piece of foam rubber or felt or whatever it is, which if you didn't know the character and you just saw that still frame, I'm not sure you would even, it would reconcile into like, oh, that's a frog or even that's an animal. and yet, my God, it's an image and a character I've like identified with since before I could talk. Some of that is because of acting, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, that's, you know, I mentioned before how important, you know, taking on these characters it is to be a good mimic and do your homework. But yeah, it helps to also be an actor and to have these other talents as well. And Jim and Frank and Jerry Nelson and Richard Hunt and Carol Spinney. All of them. And Dave Goles, who is still performing Gonzo,
yeah.
Which is, he is, I cherish him. He's so amazing. It's so wonderful, you know, that he's still performing. And we have this connection, this lifeline to the era that preceded us. But yeah, the acting is so, it's critical. Absolutely. And with puppets, we, you know, we go broad because subtle is very hard. And we go broad because we're given license to because they are puppets. But there's a lot of finesse as well that goes into it. And I'm always just in awe of my colleagues. Yeah, I love watching my friends perform and continuing to learn from them because they all bring something unique and magical, and it's so much fun to watch.
I want to say a few words about Astoria. You know, as mentioned earlier, Craig is the guest curator for the Henson Film Series at the Museum of the Moving Image. And for any of our listeners who may not know, the Museum of the Moving Image is in Astoria, Queens, here in New York City. And it is the old Kaufman Astoria Studios where Coconuts and Animal Crackers were both filmed. You have spent a good deal of time out there, Craig. I assume it must be on your mind sometimes that this is where the Wyatt Duck scene was filmed and so on.
You know what, Eric works there every day and actually in the
I work there with Craig's lovely and talented wife, Stephanie.
Yeah, Stephanie DeBruce, and Craig's wife, Muppet performer and great
I've heard
puppeteer.
Of her.
You've heard of her. You're a fan, aren't you?
I am.
But yeah, it's we're actually in the building. We shoot Sesame Street in the same building.
I didn't realize
that the Marx Brothers shot Coconuts and Animal Crackers. And it's funnily enough, I think it was it took an invitation to this podcast for me to actually request a tour of the studio, and I did that just this past week. I did that, and oh my gosh, let me tell you, I just walking on to that stage gave me chills. It's an amazing, it's an amazing stage. It's
which stage is it? Is the one on the first
floor?
It's
stage E. It's stage E on the first floor, and it's still there. It's all 26,000 square feet of it, and it's 40 feet to the grid. It's a big studio. Yeah, it's probably the biggest there was in New York at the time. And gosh, I could smell Groucho cigar. I just felt them in the room when I walked in there.
There's no sand on the floor left over from it.
Yeah, or soaking wet pieces of paper, any wet maps lying around.
No, but there are vestiges from the past.
Yeah, it's the same craft service food.
Yes.
Eric, is it the same stage that Sesame was in when they were on the first floor?
No. So Sesame Street, we moved from the first floor to the second floor, but we originally were where the back lot used to be, and that's all been turned into studio space now. And there used to be a pool in the basement, and I'm wondering if that's where, you know, maybe the opening scenes of Coconuts were done, because I was watching it just the other day, and I saw a little bit of water over on the right-hand side in the opening scene. And I was wondering, is that where the pool was? It's fun to play detective like that. I don't believe there are any logs from that time. Or if there are, they've been stashed in some warehouse with the Ark of the Covenant. Because the military actually came into the Astoria Studios and took over for a period of like 30 years. It's where all of the military's training films were shot and edited. It's a studio with a really, really interesting history.
And the Museum of the Moving Image used to be part of that complex, and then it got cut off and given to the museum to start that back in the 80s, I think.
Well, that's remarkable. There is a very, very real, very physical Muppet Marx Brothers connection that's also a major New York City landmark. Well, this has just been an absolute...
Wait.
Okay.
I have a question before we get out of here. I have a question. So do either of you guys have like a dream Muppet project that you think, oh, they'll never do, or we'll never get off the ground, or isn't feasible, but you think about?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. I have several, but one of them, which would probably be of interest to you all, is I'd love to see the Muppets actually do a remake of one of the Marx Brothers movies. I don't know if that's possible with rights and whatnot. Well, maybe we could improve upon that one, huh?
Yeah, because there's a Muppet Wonderful Life, isn't there? It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
I watched recently with Edward. It could easily be done. It could easily be done.
How would you cast that?
It's challenging, isn't it?
Yeah.
It may be that the brain donor's approach would be correct. Like, instead of making it one-to-one matchups of the characters, sort of, you know, I mean, Kermit and Fozzie and Gonzo as the central trio of the Great Muppet Capers sort of feel like the Marx Brothers, even though you couldn't quite say, well, he's Groucho, he's Harpo, and he's Chico. Maybe that's the answer.
Animal as Harpo has a lot of possibilities, I think.
Yes, right? Great girl chasers of cinema.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can see. I can see that. I can see, Pepe, the King Prawn, could be Chico. Mm-hmm. You know, if you really wanted to go with, you know, the dialect comedy.
And Piggy would be Margaret Dumont.
And for some reason, I feel like Rolf the dog could actually play Groucho. It's a tough one because of all of Groucho's put downs. And you know, there aren't too many characters in the Muppets who can get away with that.
There isn't really a smart aleck in the Muppets, is there? That's a good point. There's the, you know, they're kind of... You know, Fozzie, you know, delivers jokes, but in a completely kind of gauche way. There really isn't a smart aleck.
Well, a Stadler and Waldorf, I suppose, but you wouldn't really put them as Groucho because you wouldn't put them at the center of the story.
Now, Rolf, he does the Dr. Bob sketches, the veterinarian's hospital sketches, and in those there's, you know, it's really fast and frantic, and there is put down humor in it. There's a certain artifice about that sketch, which allows him to be a little bit more mean-spirited, but he gets away with it.
Yes, I'd forgotten that entirely, but yes, those sketches are full of, you know, the patient is sinking. I wonder what he's sinking about, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very fast, very yeah.
But that would be a dream project for me, absolutely.
And I've wanted to do, I actually, back before the Muppets ended up at Disney, I actually brought this to Henson to do, the title was The Muppets Save the World. And it was basically a superhero movie. And the Muppets get superpowers, you know, driving home from the movies and there's a big storm or something. And they all get different powers and... the one that I liked the most was Gonzo, who had the power to shapeshift, but only into the last thing that he saw. And they were coming from seeing a Matt Damon movie. So the whole movie is Gonzo switching back and forth between Gonzo and Matt Damon.
Wow. That is such a great idea. It's such a Muppety idea, but not
but
specific.
Now, you know, now that the Muppets are part of the whole Marvel universe with Disney, you know, they could do a big superhero movie with the Muppets and the Marvel characters interacting.
That is hilarious. That is hilarious. What's also funny is that working with my buddy Matt Vogel, who plays Kermit the Frog now, we came up with a script with the exact same title, but we can totally change it to The Muppets Destroy the World, and it'll work just the same. It's okay.
I would be first in line under either of those titles on a marquee. Speaking of dream Muppet projects, my friend David Levy, who co-hosts the Muppeturgy podcast. When I told him you guys were going to be on our podcast, he said, oh, you must tell them. His idea is he thinks it's time for Miss Piggy to do her Cafe Carlyle cabaret residency.
Okay.
That means
that Eric's arm is going to get awfully sore.
Oh, yeah, right.
She'll make an appearance and then go away, maybe.
One of the things that a lot of people don't think about is when we do some of these live things, it's, you know, it's a challenge for the performers to keep their arms up in the air for a long time, especially a character like Piggy, who is always has this enormously heavy wardrobe. You know, everyone, you know, Fozzie's naked, Kermit's naked, you know, more or less. But Piggy always has this elaborate wardrobe. So, you know, whenever I write for Eric, I'm always trying to think of ways to get things shorter. And we did a thing when we had Piggy in New Zealand. It was, you know, I came up with a gag where we did this whole big introduction of Piggy singing Never Before, Never Again. And when we get to the song, she sings the opening and then goes right into the finale. And I said, well, you just didn't sing a lot of the song. And we came up with a reason. And it's like, well, you know, the less that she sings, more time for the audience to appreciate her. And then I had Kermit say, yeah, we've always gotten in feedback from the audience that the less Miss Piggy sings, the more they appreciate it. So, you know, what's fun to, for me is figuring out how to turn the real world, you know, situation that we're in into something in the character world that can be a gag or a joke.
Yeah, that's, yeah, that was a fun one. I remember that. And justifying it in such a way that, you know, it was a joke. You always want your justification to be a joke.
Yeah, because if you like don't point it out, purposeful. It's just Miss Piggy didn't sing very long.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Did you guys want to address that Monkey Business Punch and Judy show? Oh,
right. Point, counterpoint?
I mean, I laughed the first time I saw it. So that to me was all I needed, all the proof I needed that it's funny.
Were you offended that there wasn't a puppeteer?
No, you never want to see the puppeteer. If you see the puppeteer, you're doing your job wrong.
Yeah, I think I probably also enjoyed that scene when I first saw it, and I, you know, my comments about it, which I almost regret because it's been, it has outlived that conversation so much. Sometimes I see people at events and they say, you're the guy who doesn't like the Punch and Judy scene, aren't you? Yeah, I suppose my reaction, my more negative reaction to it does have to do with, you know, many repeated viewings and also the way when we would do our deep dives into these movies, sometimes if you have anything to say that isn't totally glowing, you're so grateful for it because any note of dissent on the show makes things more interesting, you know? And so, here's something. I have something to say other than this is perfect and brilliant and I love it.
Do you think it falls under the classification of Harpo speaking, his use of the little device?
The swazzle?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah. I think there's two questions here. One is if, like, are we supposed to read it as Harpo's character making those vocal sounds or not? And then also, is Harpo, the actor, actually making the sounds? Yeah, it's a good point, actually. I've never heard that scene really discussed in the Harpo speaking debate. But yeah, his puppet does make sounds that seem to have a lot to do with what's going on, right? That's a good question. And when the first mate pokes him in the ass with the pin, he makes there's a vocal response that would have to be coming from Harpo.
And doesn't he say he's choking me to death at one point?
Yeah, but that's the other puppet, right?
Oh, is it?
Maybe not.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, now we got to watch this damn scene again.
I have a feeling this is going to become a whole other episode.
Oh, that's a good question, though, and I don't think I've ever, like, it belongs on that list with the sneeze and at the circus.
Yeah, it does.
Other times when we think maybe we hear a little bit of Harpo's voice.
Mm-hmm.
Good question. Well, that's why it's such a great scene. It's enigmatic.
All right, well, I did my job here then today. I convinced you that it was that scene should stay in the picture.
You win, you winner. Oh, wow. Well, is there anything else anyone wants to add to this before we wrap it up? This has been a total pleasure.
Well, I had one little story that I could to add to this is that when they were doing, this was a TV special, I'm sure Eric remembers, The Muppets Go to the Movies. And it was like a 1 hour.
Was that where they did Casablanca and recreated scenes from all these films?
Yeah, it was a special promoting The Great Muppet Caper, I think. And it was a 1 hour with Lily Tomlin and
Dudley Moore, I think.
Mm-hmm. And they had established Fozzie Bear's writer during The Muppet Show was a character named Gags Beasley that we never saw. And
oh, he wrote the banana sketch.
Yes, exactly. And so they, in this show, this Muppets Go to the Movies, they establish in some on-screen newspaper headlines that Gags had a brother, Gummo Beasley, which had to be inspired by another famous Gummo. So at the end of the credits, Jerry Jewell, I would imagine, had Gummo added to the list of writers for this show. And it's like Jim Henson, Jerry Jewell, Chris Langham, and then a big gap and said, and Gummo. And then years later, there was a production accountant who called me and she's like, I'm doing the residuals on The Muppets Go to the Movies. Who's Gummo? And if I was smart, I would have said, I'm Gummo.
Yeah.
Send the check to me. But Jerry Jewell had no idea when he added this the name Gummo to the credits that it would cause turmoil in the production accounting department. I had to explain to her that, Catherine, there was no Gummo. It's a joke. And she's like, you know.
Is that maybe the only on-screen credit Gummo has ever enjoyed?
Possibly.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we want to thank our very special guest stars, Craig Shemin and Eric Jacobson, for joining us for this off-the-beaten-path episode of the Marx Brothers Council podcast. It has really been such a pleasure to talk to you both and to have my Muppet Marx connections validated by such authorities. What do we have coming up to promote? I certainly want to recommend Craig's book, Sam and Friends, The Story of Jim Henson's First Television Show. The foreword is by Frank Oz. If you are an old school Muppet fan like me, you've been hearing about Sam and Friends, you know, mentioned in documentaries, little clips here and there. You kind of know what it was. But after you read this book, you will really know what it was. It's a great book and an indispensable piece of history. What else
and
do you have?
It will soon be joined by another companion volume.
Oh, tell us about that.
It is called The Sam and Friends Script Book. And the nice people at the Henson Company and the Henson family have given me the okay to reprint, I think a little more than 60 of Jim's Sam and Friends scripts, a couple of Jerry Jewell's Sam and Friends scripts, because he came in the last 13 weeks of the show, and with my notes and annotations. And most hopefully it will include a foreword by the aforementioned Dave Goals. And I say hopefully because he hasn't finished it yet, but if he's listening, Dave, whenever you're ready. So that is happening, and that will be published by our good friends at Bear Manor Media, hopefully by the end of the year, but maybe not. And then I'm also started work on a book about Jack Benny's guest appearances on television. Which will be called, and our very special guest star, Jack Benny, and also from Bear Manor. So that's that'll be a while longer because deep in research.
Wow. Well, there's two books on my list for sure.
And I invite everyone to keep coming to the Museum of the Moving Image for our monthly Henson screenings. And that includes you, Eric, whenever you're in the neighborhood.
Where could people go? Is there an internet destination, people looking for information about the Henson screenings?
Yes, you can go to the Museum of the Moving Image website or go to jimhensonlegacy.org and get on our mailing list, and we'll send occasional emails out with all the news. And people can visit my website, craigshemin.com, or samandfriendsbook.com for information about the Sam Friends book. And if anybody has the book or buys the book and sends me proof that they have it, I'll be happy to send them an autographed book plate and a bookmark and a little postcard and a sticker and all that stuff. And all that information's on the samandfriendsbook.com website.
Get thee to it, listeners. And if you want to enjoy the work of Eric Jacobson, virtually any Muppet product of recent decades will get you there. Is there anything coming up, Eric? Anything you want to plug or promote? I mentioned at the top of the show the Muppets Mayhem, which I thought was a tremendous achievement, and particularly the new insight into the origins of Animal are something I'll always keep with me.
Nothing big. We just wrapped on season 55 of Sesame Street. That won't start showing until next fall, at least.
Well, nobody learned to read until then.
Yeah.
Did it end with a cliffhanger?
No. So nothing immediate to promote, but we all appreciate everybody, you know, having tuned into Muppets Mayhem. That was a joy to make. And keep watching Sesame Street with your kids. Keep me gainfully employed. Yeah. Thanks.
That's a promise.
Well, let's promote. I think your wonderful voiceover announcer will mention Matthew's book, but let's mention it again.
Let's mention Matthew's book, The Annotated Marx Brothers. And let's mention another of Matthew's books.
And this one.
That's Me, Groucho. And yet another, and the Annotated Abbott and Costello. How many of these books do you have, Matthew?
I'm running out of things to annotate. If anybody knows anything that they want me to annotate, just let me know and I'll do it.
Well, one thing I've learned about writing these books is that it's a volume business if you want to get a decent amount of royalties.
Actually, annotating The Muppet Show would be quite a...
I have pitched that to the powers that be at Disney.
Oh, that'd be good.
That's legitimate idea, yeah.
I'm hoping also that the Muppet Character Encyclopedia is like 10 years old now and needs updating. So I've brought that to them. So we'll see what happens.
I have a grocery list that needs annotating.
Send it to Matthew. He'll take care of that.
Okay.
It'll be published by Bear Manor Media in the fall.
We will close with a quick Patreon update. As always, we want to say thank you to our Patreon subscribers. Your postcard for the month of March has been slightly delayed. It is sitting right here in front of me as we record this, all stamped and addressed. All I have to do is walk to the mailbox, and you'll get to see me do that on video, probably before this episode comes out. But thank you to all our subscribers. If for some reason you are not a subscriber, please consider visiting MarxBrothersCouncilPodcast.com and clicking the big orange Patreon button. Fabulous rewards await you, including monthly bonus segments, monthly postcards in your actual physical mailboxes, and lots of nice swaggy gifts.
And can I just interrupt to say how lovely the Thelma postcard was? That was yours, wasn't it?
Thank you. Yes, our February postcard was a drawing by me of the lovely Thelma Todd.
It was absolutely delightful. It's gone into immediate service as a bookmark.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad you liked it, Matthew. And just so everyone knows, if you subscribe to the podcast now, you'll get the last few postcards. I usually send to new subscribers the current postcard and about the last two. We recently crossed the line where I now have to order larger quantities of the postcards in order to get them to all our subscribers, which means I have more of each design left over at the end than I used to. So for a while, you can count on, if you subscribe in April, you'll probably get the February, March, and April postcards. So you could have your very own copy of that Thelma Todd postcard that Matthew finds so pleasant. If you subscribe now. Well, that brings us down to the end of another one. But before we go, we want to say thank you one more time to our very special guest stars, Eric Jacobson and Craig Shemin. And now here's our closing music. It's Lydia the Tattooed Lady, as performed by Rolf the Dog off his album Old Brown Ears Is Back.
Lydia, oh Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia the Tattooed Lady. She has eyes that folks adore so, and a torso even more so. Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo. Beside it, the wreck of the Hesperus II. And proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia. La-dee-da, la-da-dum, la-dee-da, la-da-dum, la-da-dum, doo-dee-doo-dee-doo. She can give you a view of the world in tattoo if you step up and tell her where. For a dime you can see Kankakee or Paris or Washington crossing the Delaware. La-dee-da, la-da-dum. Lydia, oh Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia the Tattooed Lady. When her muscles start relaxing, up the hill comes Andrew Jackson. Lydia, oh Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia the champ of them all. She once swept an admiral clear off his feet. The ships on her hips made his heart skip a beat. And now the old boy's in command of the fleet. For he went and married Lydia.
The Marx Brothers Council podcast is produced by Bob Gasell. Matthew Cunningham's books, The Annotated Marx Brothers, and That's Me, Groucho, are published by McFarland. Noah Diamond's book, Give Me a Thrill, The Story of All Say She is published by Bear Manor Media. For more info on this and all episodes, visit our website at MarxBrothersCouncilPodcast.com. Also look for us on
X.
And for the place to talk Marx and meet fellow fans, join us on the lively Marx Brothers Council Facebook group. See you next time!
Groucho, Groucho. Anybody with the word grouch in their name is okay by me.